Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
Obviously, you know, Wednesday was the deadline for Mr. Stringer to provide the evidence that apparently him and his attorney wanted to withhold. From my understanding, is that evidence probably was so damning that he didn't want anyone to see it, that he preferred to actually resign instead.
I was hoping that Mr. Stringer would come to the table, bring the documents, show us, and we could make an educated decision when the vote came. And that didn't happen. We don't have that opportunity. So now we just have to move forward.
In order for me to win that primary, it would be a very bitter, bitter primary. And I'm not willing to risk that seat to Martha McSally or to Donald Trump. I'd rather spend more time with my kid than engage in an 18-month fight with another fellow Democrat. It's not worth it.
The volunteers and hopefully a lot more people are very anxious to get started and to stop dirty money in Arizona, to stop the anonymous cash that has just flooded our state and I think corrupted our politics.
And now with us to talk about David Stringer resigning from the legislature, Congressman Ruben Gallego deciding against a Senate run, and more, our attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera and Paul Bentz of High Ground. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So, Paul, long process to get to David Stringer ultimately resigning. Just from an opinion standpoint, not behind the scenes, could he have made this just a lot easier on himself and everyone else by resigning, I don't know, a couple of months ago?
Well, certainly he could have made it easier on himself. But I think the process did what it was supposed to do. And kudos to Speaker Bowers and the legislature for not jumping to conclusions several months ago and taking immediate action to try to kick him out. Let the process take hold. Give him every opportunity. He just did not decide to take those and instead let it draw out.
Roy, what are your thoughts generally about that?
Well, I'm at the risk of being the world's most boring guest, I am one of the outside counsel to the House Ethics Committee, so I can't talk about any of the specifics of the investigation, other than to say that I think it was a thorough investigation and it was a fair investigation. Had it continued, I think that the Ethics Committee and the legislature would have considered, the things that we found and made, what they thought would be the appropriate action, whether that's expulsion or not. But of course, all of this has sort of ended sooner than that with him deciding to resign, which, as the speaker has indicated, was the preferred option as opposed to going through legislative action.
Paul, does it matter at all that we ultimately don't know whether he was guilty of what he was accused of or exactly what happened? Like, we don't really have any idea what was in those documents that he refused to release. Does that matter?
Well, once he refused to release the documents, to borrow a line from the Avengers, we were in the end game. I mean, it was not going to change the result. I think there was, from the outset, that it did not sound great from the initial, and it would have taken quite a bit, I think, in those documents to change people's minds. I think there was a lot of folks that had already come to a conclusion, but it was very wise for the body to be deliberate about this, to let the process work, and they should take it seriously before they remove a member. It's not something that happens very often. Yes, it happened a year ago, but that's the first time in decades that the body had actually voted to remove somebody, so I think that's the way they should approach it.
Roy, do you have a sense of how big of a distraction this was at the Capitol? Like, did it affect day-to-day business at all, this, that his situation was kind of hanging over everything?
I mean, I think it was a major distraction, a major political distraction, certainly. I mean, he was, a member of the legislature throughout this whole process, on the floor and participating. I think now it's also a bit of a distraction because Republicans are down one member in the House, which, makes their majority very narrow. And I think you're not going to see much going on at the legislature until a replacement is announced for Mr. Stringer.
Now, one of the names we've heard, at least based on the Capital Times reporting, is former Senate President Steve Pierce. Paul, let me go to you on this. So Steve Pierce was a guy who certainly would be considered a moderate, I think, in the big picture of things, at least a pragmatist to some extent. Would Republicans, we know how the process goes, would Republicans be looking for someone whose views maybe are more conservative, like Representative Stringer, though not with the other baggage attached to it, or is a Steve Pierce more of a pragmatist a fit?
Well, they're going to meet on Sunday and decide, and they'll put forth three candidates, and then those will go before the county supervisors. I think Steve Pierce is a good fit. I think the legislature right now, in the middle of the budget and everything else, is looking for someone who understands the process, looking for someone they can count on to vote, not someone they have to show the bathrooms to or introduce how the process works. They want someone who can jump in with both feet, and I think Steve Pierce does fit the bill for that.
Yeah.
Does it? It seems like it might be more of an important decision, given, Roy, as you referenced earlier, a very narrow margin, just a couple vote majority in the House. It kind of matters who is appointed to that. Obviously, it has to be a Republican. Everybody knows that district is fairly conservative. But whether or not, like, sort of where on the continuum of Republican that person is seems to make a difference.
Oh, certainly. I mean, we, you know, it's been a 31-29 majority in the House for Republicans. That's the most narrow it's been in a very long time. I think both caucuses have a sort of, you know, big tent to them. And so certainly if a replacement is coming in from the far right, that might make, you know, bipartisanship a bit more difficult. Whereas if it's somebody in, you know, in the middle, a moderate who could potentially be peeled off by Democrats or potentially wants to work with Democrats, that might make bipartisanship more possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Pierce was very conservative as the president of the Senate. I think he's very popular in that district. I think he represents well the ethic of District 1, that sort of Yavapai County, Prescott area, and I think he'd fit in well representing their interests.
Yeah, Senator Pierce always struck me, though, as more of a business type based on his ranching and whatnot. He seemed to be someone who's more of a pragmatist. It kept coming to mind, whether he's conservative or not, Paul.
Yeah, I think he's been a thoughtful legislator all the way through.
Yeah. Roy, let me ask this. I'm not sure if this comes into the investigation realm, and if it does, obviously let us know. Compare, if you would, how Rusty Bowers handled this as Speaker as opposed to how Speaker Mesner went about the operation with Don Shuter.
Well, you know, with Don Shuter, there wasn't an investigation that was done, right? And so I do have to sort of give kudos to the current Speaker and to Chairman Shope. To Paul's point, I mean, this is an extraordinary action to expel somebody from the legislature. And so to go forward and make that kind of decision, I think you need to have all the facts. And so what we had this time was a thorough investigation looking into all of those facts, which we didn't have before. Although, you know, the writing was probably already on the wall without an investigation, as we saw with Shuter.
How do you think we should be looking at what current legislators did in their lives before they were in the legislature? And not to say that any of what Mr. Stringer was accused of doing is okay, not to condone it in any way, but is there something to be said for letting voters decide sort of what if somebody did something, you know, decades ago that maybe it doesn't necessarily matter to their, you know, to their current position in a state body?
Well, you can make an argument either way. I mean, I think that, yes, you know, voters get to ultimately decide who represents them. That's our democracy. But at the same time, and I think I've said this on this show before, there are minimum standards, I think, that we should expect of our leaders, expect of the people who serve in the legislature. And if, you know, certain statements or behaviors in the past don't meet those standards, then they don't deserve to be there.
I tend to agree. I think our elected officials are held to a higher standard. The other thing here is that there's, I think, some leeway should be granted to folks who are honest about their background or about their history. If they come forth and explain themselves, and if he had produced documents that said what he had said they said, and other folks have done this in the past where they've admitted past wrongdoings, then you can give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. People grow, people change. But in this case, that's not exactly what happened.
Paul, do you think absent the revelations about what happened in Maryland in the 80s, Stringer would be in this position? Would he have been forced to resign basically just based on the statements that he'd made, the racist comments he made?
No. Based on the comments alone, I'm not sure that he would have been removed. I think there have been a lot of people who would have called for his removal, but I do think it's the revelations from Maryland that really put it over the top.
Roy, what do you think?
I can't really talk about those allegations, but you know certainly the Maryland allegations were on top of other things that people had concerns with, including previous comments that he made.
Well, let's move on to Ruben Gallego. Congressman Gallego decided not to run for Senate. You, among many of us, I think, expected at some point for him to make an announcement. I think a lot of expected the announcement to go the other way. Ultimately, do you think this is about the party? Is it about his own future? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it was an act of leadership in a lot of ways by Congressman Gallego. You know, I think ultimately Democrats recognize that the number one goal next year is defeating Donald Trump and defeating Martha McSally. And I think he looked at, you know, the chance that him entering the primary and making it a divisive primary would leave, you know, the Democratic nominee potentially damaged shortly before the general election next year. And that risk, I think, was too great for Congressman Gallego. And so I think it was an act of leadership. As I've said before, he's a really young member of Congress. And I think before it's all said and done, we probably will see a Senator Gallego representing Arizona. But hopefully next year it's Senator Kelly.
How hard must that be, though? I mean, obviously, Congressman Gallego thinks highly of himself, which is great. He obviously thinks he can accomplish a lot of things. He has been very, very verbal in his criticism of the president. He is not a shy person. So how difficult is that to think, you know what, maybe I'm not the right call in this one? I mean, that must be brutal to think about.
Well, I mean, all politicians are ambitious, yes, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, Rubin is one of my closest personal friends. I know him very well. And I think ultimately, though, his goal is the same, is the right goal, right? The goal is to make sure that Donald Trump and Martha McSally don't return to Washington. And I think he, you know, had the foresight to look at what potentially could happen, even though recognizing he could have won himself. But instead of going forward and sort of testing that out, stepping aside and making the right decision. And I think he's going to do, in his current position, everything he can to make sure that Democrats win next year.
So, Paul, this obviously changes the dynamic dramatically. Does this make it in any ways easier on Martha McSally knowing that she has one candidate, or does it make it harder because it doesn't look like the Democrats are going to have a bloody primary?
I think it makes it more difficult. Republicans for the past 30 years or so have really suffered from brutal primaries all the way back to Napolitano winning the attorney general's race after a bruising Republican primary on the other side. And it's not something Republicans are very good at. This is actually a very mature decision by a gay ego to do this and avoid that bloody primary. And while it does give McSally the opportunity to frame her opponent early, I think that many Republicans would have rather tried to attack Gallego and some of his comments about the president. You've got now she's head-to-head with another former military member. They both were pilots. But he also has the added value that he was an astronaut. There are very few people that folks consider American heroes anymore, but astronauts are still on that list.
Do you think that this is the general election then? Do you anticipate on either side other candidates jumping in?
There might be other candidates. I think this is the headliner. We might see a tangential candidate on either side jump in. You might see a far right candidate try to challenge McSally. But at the end of the day, I think this is the matchup that we're looking at. We've got it pretty far ahead of time to see how this goes.
Roy, do you think this is it, or do you think there might be somebody else?
I think this is it. I mean, there's always a chance that some sort of more minor candidate would enter the primary on either side, but I think ultimately this is it. I think this is where sort of the establishment on the Republican side and Democratic side are going to be. And I think, these are probably the two best. I mean, certainly on the Democratic side, the strongest candidate we could have put up. And I think Republicans will probably say the same thing about McSally. So it's going to be quite a fight.
Roy, do you agree with Congressman Gallego's assessment that his path to the primary nomination would have been just a really ugly, nasty, bitter primary?
I don't know. I mean, it could have been, right? It's hard to tell. I think that both Rubin and Mark are good people and honorable people. So it's hard to tell whether they would have gotten immediately negative on each other. But certainly when you try to contrast yourself with an opponent that gives potential fodder to the other side, to the other party, that could be used against your candidate. So that could have potentially been damaging.
Negative campaigning works, unfortunately. And that's why we see most of the ads that you see on television are negative or hit pieces on somebody. It would have been nasty. They would have pointed out that Kelly was formerly a Republican. They would have tried to draw some separations between the two. We've seen that Democrats did well in 2018 in less contentious primaries. We saw, and they won a lot of statewide offices for the first time in many years. I think that's the conventional wisdom right now on how to avoid those primaries to give you the best shot of winning.
Paul, we've actually gone a couple of minutes without one of us saying Kyrsten Sinema's playbook. So I will ask you that. Is Mark Kelly going to follow that playbook and try to come across as an independent who has Democratic ties but is more of a middle-of-the-roader independent?
I think that's where they're going to go. This is going to be the largest turnout we've seen in a long time, maybe ever in Arizona history. We're anticipating at least 2.8 million voters. That's 500,000 more voters than voted in the Sinema's election. And those are younger, more Democratic, more independent-leaning audiences. He would be wise to follow that playbook that she did and go out and try to cultivate those audiences and bring them along.
Roy, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, will Democrats, I mean, certainly those that want to win, and I imagine most of them do, will embrace Mark Kelly. But is there a concern that he was a Republican at some point, even if he wasn't passionate about it? He hasn't been a member of the party. Is there any parallel to Mark Kelly and Grant Woods from that sort of thin sliver?
You know, I don't think so. And I think the reason for that is because Mark, well, one, is married to Gabrielle Giffords, who's a beloved, you know, former member, Democratic member of Congress, right, a hero. And then also the leadership on gun control, which has typically been a Democratic issue, I think really helps him, you know, sort of show his bona fides. To your earlier question, I mean, I do think that he is going to run as more of a moderate and use the sort of Senator Sinema playbook because it worked. I mean, it literally worked against Martha McSally just last year. So I think that's the smart move.
How much do you think that gun control will come to play in that election? Because in his announcement video, he didn't mention it at all. Haven't really heard much about his work. And he's done a lot of work. He and Congresswoman Giffords have done a lot of work on that issue. Do you anticipate that it would come up from him? Presumably, Martha McSally and the Republicans would bring it up, try and use it against him, I would imagine.
I think it certainly will come up. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I don't think that, you know, going into next year, that is going to be among the top issues. And the reason I think that is because this election is going to happen during a presidential year. So I think ultimately the biggest issue on the ballot is going to be Trump. And then in addition to that, I think as we've seen in the announcement video for Mark Kelly, there's going to be a lot of focus on the economy and healthcare costs, jobs, things like that, because I think that's ultimately most important.
I think the two issues that are going to come up the most will be immigration and health care. The president said suddenly the Republicans are going to be the party of health care. I think there's many who believe that 2018 was won by many Democrats because of health care. I'm not sure if that's 100% so, but we do have an immigration crisis that's coming to the state, and I think that's going to be an issue that's talked about. But on Kelly's gun control issue, the majority of the electorate is with him. They don't think we need assault rifles. They think it's reasonable for people to register for a gun. I don't think the majority of the electorate believes that we need bump stocks and other items like that. So he's not far out of the mainstream when it comes to those reasonable gun control items. So I don't think he's going to have to spend a lot of time defending his position on that.
That's Paul Bentz. Also here is Roy Herrera with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday newscap, and we continue after this. And thanks for listening to the Friday Newscap here on the show on 91.5 KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guest today, Paul Bentz of High Ground, and attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, let's talk about the Green New Deal, such as it is. Senator Sinema has decided to come out actually against the Green New Deal, though she did say she supported a lot of other environmental measures. Generally, people will say she has a 6-year term. So does this indicate she really is against the Green New Deal? From a political standpoint and a policy standpoint, where is she on this?
Well, I mean, I think there's a question about what the Green New Deal is still, right? I mean, it seems at this point to be less sort of specific policy and more about sort of general pronouncements about how you feel about climate change. And I think that, and she said this in her comments about it, is that ultimately she's interested in sort of what are realistic options, policy options that we could accomplish to address climate change. And I think ultimately that's what she's interested in doing. You know, we did see a couple of other moderate Democratic senators also vote against it. And it was brought, I mean, it's important to realize it was brought up symbolically, really, by the Republican controlled Senate to try to put Democrats on the record to be on it. So clearly, to be for it. So clearly Republicans think that this somehow will play in their favor.
So this won't hurt her politically, obviously, but how about as far as the electorate feels about her for a while on this issue, as far as progressives?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be, I think, some progressives that are critical of her. I think we saw that last, you know, during the election cycle last year. But ultimately, Democrats overwhelmingly voted for her. And I think that Democrats overwhelmingly still support her. You know, she did things that, you know, for votes that, like this that may be frustrating to people. You know, she took votes, for example, against Trump's emergency declaration on the border, which I think a lot of Democrats would agree with is the wrong decision. So, you know, you can't satisfy everybody. I think that certainly if she's viewing herself as a legacy to Senator McCain, just like Senator McCain, you know, took votes that frustrated his own party, I think that's going to happen sometimes.
And Paul, what do you think about Sinema's take on that? And could McSally have done anything other than she did on this?
I think it's incredibly smart, and she continues to navigate well beyond the election. There's a lot of folks that said, oh, she's going to act this way during the election and then suddenly become this very liberal, very progressive Democrat. I think she's navigating incredibly well, made the right points that she needed to make to appeal to the audience while casting a vote that I think keeps her in the good graces of the overall general electorate. I do think we have to think about the implications long term. Democrats are facing a progressive uprising very similar to the Tea Party on the right. There's going to be a Tea Party of the left, and there's folks who pushing the Green New Deal who very much represent that ethos. And I think long term, 6 years from now, she might have something to deal with in that effect. But right now, it's the smart move on her part. And so from that perspective, I think she was very wise. McSally did exactly what McSally ought to have done to continue to appeal to her base. I'll tell you, my father, who is a lifelong Republican, was telling me the other day about how bad the Green New Deal is because Fox News told him how bad the Green New Deal is. So I think it was very wise for her to take the position that she did.
When you have a senator, as Steve referenced, obviously a six-year term, how much does any one vote or maybe series of votes in their first year matter 5 years later when they start thinking about reelection?
Well, I think not in any individual vote. They're trying to hang people on individual votes, but it comes down to an attitude, comes down to how they conduct themselves and where they are as part of the body. I mean, we saw that with Senator Flake. It's sort of he made some controversial votes along the way, but really wasn't any single vote. It's more of how he acted within the body that sort of made him out of step with the primary voting Republicans. Sinema needs to be mindful of that when it comes to primary voting Democrats in 6 years, but I think right now she's looking at the long game and playing it quite wisely.
Roy, do you think it's possible? I mean, obviously we're putting the cart well before the horse. You're looking 6 years out. I mean, could Kyrsten Sinema face a credible challenge from the left?
I don't think so. But, you know, again, we're 6 years out, so it's hard to say, you know, where we'd be at or where the party's going to be at. I think there is a wing to the party that is, you know, an insurgent wing to the party that is more progressive. But I think ultimately, if you look at a state like Arizona, I think that how Senator Sinema has represented us is pretty reflective, I think, of the electorate here. And so even Democrats. And so I think ultimately she's not really going to have a problem, even if there was a progressive challenger.
Now, Roy, is that a breath of fresh air or is that because we still are in this age of partisan politics. We know that. We have many independents in Arizona, but very few of those independents are truly independent in that sense. So is she just one of the savviest politicians, frankly, we've seen in a decade or more in Arizona?
Certainly. I mean, I think that she is one of the savviest that we've seen. Personally, I'm fine with how she represents us. I think it's, again, an accurate reflection of what the electorate is. And I think that she's just, you know, pragmatic and looking for, you know, actual, you know, common sense and realistic solutions to the problems that we have, as opposed to throwing bombs, against partisanship.
Paul, is Senator Sinema in the early stages of being on that Mount Rushmore of Arizona politicians?
Well, I definitely think Roy talked about it, and it's very wise that she's trying to follow the footsteps and be the next Senator McCain. Now, Senator McCain is on the Mount Rushmore of Arizona politics, and so if she achieves that goal over years and years, perhaps so. For now, though, I think she is embracing that mantle of maverick and really looking at the issues wisely, and at the moment, she's definitely headed in that direction. Mm-hmm.
Guys, this week, Terry Goddard said he was going to try again to get an initiative to ban what he's calling dirty money, others call dark money, out of campaigns. Is there any reason to think that he's going to have any more luck this time than he had last time when he got signatures, but they were enough of them were invalidated that the measure didn't make the ballot?
Well, I think we're going to have a similar challenge this year. I mean, if he does get enough signatures, and ultimately is able to file this thing, and he's going to get a challenge, I think, certainly from the same folks from last time around. And we're going to go through this same legal analysis on the validity of the signatures and other legal challenges against the initiative. I think that ultimately most Arizonans probably, at least in the abstract, agree with what he's trying to do. So if it goes on the ballot, it probably does pass. As a campaign finance lawyer myself, I'm not sure how it would affect my business, but personally, I would vote for it because I think it's a good thing for democracy. But again, you know, it's a long path. I mean, certainly he's getting started early, and I think the reason for that is the recognition that you need to get as many signatures as possible.
Yeah, Paul, he's starting well in advance. I mean, more than a year out from when he needs to them in. He says he's going to use all volunteers this time as opposed to paid petition circulators. Will that matter?
So there's one little bit of nerdy detail that you got to bear in mind. So in 2018, we had a massive voter turnout, one of the largest turnouts for a midterm ever. That dictates the new signature requirement moving forward. So now the 2020 signature requirement went up by almost 100,000 valid signatures. So he's got to gather for a constitutional amendment over 350,000 signatures. So he has to start early, no matter whether he was using paid or volunteer. Very few volunteers volunteer-only issues have actually achieved the ballot. It's just incredibly difficult to do that. At the end of the day, I think they would be wise to bring paid signature gatherers on. I know that's not ideal, and I know that's probably not the popular opinion, but if they really want this thing to qualify, that's probably one of the things that needs to happen. But they're giving themselves as much lead time. But, I mean, we're talking about 350,000 valid, so they need to really get 500,000 signatures to make sure that they're really defended against any potential court challenge.
Well, and even though they're starting early now, they're still, you know, in a few months going to be heading into the middle of the summer when traditionally people aren't around and it's much tougher to recruit people to collect signatures and tougher to get people to sign things because they're not there.
Well, you should petition gather in San Diego, Pine Top, you know, Flagstaff, places like that in August. But it's a very difficult time. The challenges leading up to it, it passed in Phoenix overwhelmingly. It passed in Tempe overwhelmingly. All of our polling has showed that people want to crack down on dark money. They think we have a constitutional right to know where the money is coming from. It's a little more difficult in practice to do, but it's a very steep hill to climb.
Paul, obviously, Terry Goddard, very respected person, who was mayor of Phoenix, was attorney general for two terms in the state. Is there anything when it comes to what we look back at with Save Our Schools, for example, would it be good for Terry Goddard, for this movement, to actually have new blood involved in it as well, to hear from other people who are involved and people in the community? Because I think most people have a fine opinion of Terry Goddard, but he is, to a lot of people, sort of the past. Would it help a movement like this to have, hey, listen, more younger politicians or whatnot involved? Does that factor in at all?
If we were going to get to the point where this is going to be on the ballot and there's going to be an actual public campaign, I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, having the representation of the campaign be more multi-generational is a good thing, because I think in particular people that are against dark money and against this sort of money in politics are young people. I mean, I think that's a lot of the Bernie Sanders sort of supporters, if you will. And so getting people like that involved, I think, would be good for injecting energy into the campaign if we get that far. But to Paul's point, I mean, the amount of signatures you need is an enormous number. And when people ask me about the possibility of doing initiatives in Arizona now going to 2020, it's very difficult, very expensive.
Paul, you mentioned that you thought maybe they have to bring in paid circulators at some point. I'm wondering where the money to do that would come from, because the conventional wisdom is that neither political party is really interested in this because they both use dark money.
There's a lot of folks who are not interested in it because it's a lot easier to pour dark money into a race and influence the outcome, as we've seen in Arizona. So it is a very difficult fundraising effort. It is a grassroots fundraising challenge. It's funny that you mentioned Save Our Schools, because some of those Save Our Schools folks are on board with this, and they've proven. So there is some grassroots oomph behind this. It's just so many signatures. I do think it's it's $5, $10, small dollar contributions, and find some wealthy folks that believe in the good of the country. But it's a really difficult fundraising ask, that's for sure.
Guys, just our last couple of minutes left, a major issue. Charter school reform looked like it was going somewhere in the Senate. Obviously, the reform did not meet a lot of people's standards, but there was some reform. And then in the House, we talked about Speaker Bowers before, he is not allowing this bill to come forward. He's not assigning it to a committee. So, Roy, what happens with this? Is this charter school reform dead in Arizona this year?
Probably. I mean, that's certainly what it seems like in the last, week or so, which is too bad, because I think that this is one of those issues which I think people on both sides of the aisle really agree that there needs to be reform, that our system is broken in a lot of ways, in a waste of taxpayer dollars in a lot of ways. And so I think it's too bad that we've gotten to this point where likely nothing will happen, but that's what it's looking like.
Yeah. Go ahead, Paul.
I think Senator Kate Brophy McGee really started with the best intentions and really trying to bring – there's a lot of concerns following some of the news stories about how the money is being spent and who's profiting off of it. And I think the majority of the electorate wants to see something done. At the end of the day, it's going to be very difficult, because the type of compromise you're looking for is not going to make anybody happy. So it's either going to go too far or not far enough. That's how you know you probably have the right compromise there, is when everybody's mad about it. But that just makes it very difficult to pass a legislative body at that point. I think there were some good reforms in there that ought to have been considered, and others that should have been as well. It's an issue that's not going away, whether it gets addressed now. It's something that does need to be done, because it's important for people to have faith in the school system.
Do you think this is one of those issues? We see this a lot at the Capitol, where a bill is introduced one year, nothing happens. happens, a bill introduced next year, maybe it goes through a committee and on and on and on. A few years later, it eventually passes. Is this one of those issues, do you think, that maybe next year or the year after that, there might be more traction for it?
I think it's one of those bills that does require to take some momentum. It also needs everybody to take some stock on how they talk about the issue. Charter schools, if you're on one side of the aisle, if you're to the left, it's the evil, it's the bane of the existence, it's taking up all the money and punishing all the other schools. And if you're right, it's the catch-all, school choice, everybody ought to go to public or charter schools. We really need a comprehensive look at all of it. There are things that need to be done on charter schools. Public schools need more money as well. 95% of folks go to public schools. We need to look at all of it, but it's just we should – people got to come together and stop vilifying the other side on this.
Very quick final thoughts on that?
I mean, I agree. It may be one of these issues that takes a couple of sessions to get something done, because I do think we're going to continue to see news reports of more wrongdoing, more fraud, more enrichment, which is going to continue to make people upset, which will push the ball forward potentially on a legislative solution. But it's also wrapped up in a larger debate about school funding, right? And that just makes that so difficult and so complicated here in Arizona after Red for Ed and after the governor's 20 for 20. So I don't know. I mean, it's going to be difficult on how that to see how that plays out in the larger education funding debate.
That is attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Also here, Paul Bentz of High Ground. Guys, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.